William Wace Weaver loves to cook and to grow unusual varieties of vegetables, some no longer available in grocery stores. He also likes to try to understand the relationship between the food, the originator of the recipe, and the utensils used to make the food. To do this, he's reached back into America's past. He's a food historian and a writer whose intellectual appetite in food was piqued while working as an architect redesigning kitchens. Weaver curated the current exhibit at the Museum of American Folk Art in New York called America Eats, Folk Art and Food. His new book, also called America Eats, was written to accompany the exhibit. Weaver draws a parallel between what he does with food and what classical musicians do with their original instruments.
The analysis that I use is that I do with food what Christopher Hogwood does with music, okay? I try to climb inside of the mind of the cook, in this case, rather than a musician, and try to understand the milieu for the period, what their attitude was about food. So, I mean, it's a total thing. It's a total role-playing, in a sense, actually. It's being like an actor, negating my own 1990s feelings about food and reactions to hygiene and all of that.
Where is your recipe for Hop and John in here?
It's in the forward part of the book. There's a picture of Hop and John in the book as it was prepared in a hominy pot. This is the old South Carolina term for a cast iron boiler. The slave cabins in the pre-Civil War South were issued these cast iron pots. That was their main cooking implement.
Now this looks like kind of a rice stew. You've got cow peas. What are cow peas in the recipe?
Cow peas are a type of very, very old-fashioned pea that, like black-eyed peas. You've heard about black-eyed peas. Mm-hmm. It's a runner bean, and they take them out of the pots and put them in the mix this with rice and salt pork.
How far north would a recipe for Hop and John have made it? Would it have made it up into New England?
Rice became cheap in the middle of the 18th century, so farm people were getting rice in the middle Atlantic states. So this kind of a dish was probably available up and down the coast. Hop and John, however, is a dish that has become more and more focused as a South Carolina dish. I chose this mainly because in South Carolina, it's like one of their identity foods. This is something that makes them South Carolinian to eat this, particularly at New Year's. It's a New Year's dish for them now. In the pre-Civil War era, it was a food that you really didn't serve to company. Servants ate it. Poor people ate it. People in the plantation house may have served it to the kids and eaten it among themselves, but they didn't give it to company. It had no status whatsoever. Today it does.
Well, that's true of a lot of foods that are considered peasant foods. I mean, you go into a restaurant in San Francisco or Philadelphia or New York, and you've got polenta on the menu for, you know, $12.
Right.
You know, which is a very simple cornmeal dish.
Absolutely.
And it's now a vogue food.
Absolutely.
What happens? What do you see happen when a food goes from the back kitchen snack for the help to suddenly being prominent on a chic menu?
Well, it's a total role reversal for the food. This kind of cooking is homey. It conveys a sense of identity and a sense of connectedness, which I talk about in the book, a sense of being related to a certain place and people or culture. And it's not made by a machine. It's obviously been prepped in a kitchen by hand. And I think that this is part of its attractiveness to people today. This is a very interesting development that's taking place in food. This whole shift of cookery from the peasant kitchen into the restaurant, and into the kitchen of the wealthy families. The upper class people are now eating folk peasant breads because they're healthier. There's a complete flip going on here. I think that the folk cookery as a whole is going to be the cookery of the future for the upper 3%. The processed foods are going to be for the rest of us.
The white bread, the inexpensive high-starched.
Absolutely. They'll always be around.
Mm-hmm.
Also, to make many of the dishes which are now considered peasant, you have to get very, very pure, very simple ingredients. It's hard to go to a market and find cornmeal that's not tampered with. some of these old recipes don't even work with processed cornmeal or processed rice. That's another thing.
And the only places you can find these now are expensive health organic,
right. So there's a whole cost factor involved.
Yeah, I've certainly found that if you want to keep something out, you have to pay more for it.
Exactly. It shouldn't be that way, but it is.
The cooking that you're talking about, the folk cookery that went on in the 18th and 19th century, took a lot of time. I mean, was it like a full-time job?
A person who was involved in the kitchen continuously planned ahead, knowing what was in the garden as to when they would be ripe so that they would be ready to take those things into the house and process them. So I think as a whole, in folk cookery, people tended to take the most direct route. In other words, they took the recipes that were simple and easy to handle, and they stuck with things that they could predict.
If we were to take our odorophone and walk into your house this morning, what smells might we record?
In my house today, I'm doing a Christmas book. I'm cooking Christmas things. This is January. You would have the smell of chocolate apies, which are a Christmas cookie, of plum pudding boiling away, and of marmalade. I was making marmalade. I have wild oranges that I put up. Calamondins, they grow wild in Florida. They're wonderful.
Could you take us through the history of toast?
Toast.
A very simple food, warming the bread, trying to get it a certain color and getting it toast. As the nature of the cooking fires have changed, from ash fires through cook stoves to toaster ovens.
I intentionally chose toast in America Eats. I think I made a pitch for toast in there. But I think it's a valid one because, first of all, I've got to say the toast was probably the most popular snack food in the old days of hearth cooking. It was something very easy to prepare. And it was predicated on homemade bread, of course. And that's the real secret. Well, the bread and the manner of toasting it. When we go over to the cast iron cook stove, we have an intense heat. Of course, we've probably got coal in there in this part of the country. That was the most common heating fuel. So you can't hold bread over that because you're going to have coal fumes and a terrible taste coming out of it. It tends to incinerate the bread, and then you get the whole idea of, well, bread changes, of course, and it becomes this aerated sponge that we can buy today, and it doesn't make decent toast at all. It turns into something like styrofoam, and that's what happened to toast. I'm not advocating that we all go back to cooking toast over, you know, roasting it over the open hearth, but I just point out that technology has made life easy for us, but we've also had some very big trade-offs in the process.
How do you cook your toast nowadays?
When I eat toast, I do it over the hearth. I have a hearth in my bedroom. I live in an old tavern, so that's my cooking hearth.
And you cook in your bedroom?
Yes. I said that one time to a woman writing a newspaper, and then I realized, oh, this is going on all over the country. This has got a dimension to it that I don't know whether cooking classes in his bedroom and all of that, right?
Your work describes how food is prepared and has photographs of the actual implements, the kind of cast iron cooking pots, the special knives, and so forth. When you prepare one of these recipes, do you actually use these implements, or do you sort of use a modern knife or a food processor to aid you?
I'll tell you, I have two levels that I deal with in reconstructing foods. If I'm doing this for a museum, for example, Old Salem in North Carolina, which is a Moravian town, I've done some work for them, they have to have a dish that's archaeologically correct. So yes, indeed, I do it the old way. Then I look at ways that I can adapt that so that we can prep it in a modern kitchen and have it come out the same way.
Do you find that it makes a difference in the taste of the food?
Oh, absolutely. It's totally different. The mush muffins, there's a recipe for that in America Eats, are completely different when they're done on a hearth than in an oven. You can't do them. Even in a professional oven, the way they come out when you do them on a hanging griddle, that is a round cast iron griddle hanging by a hook and chain over hot coals in a hearth. There is a taste to the dough, the baked dough, and there is a texture to the crust that just simply does not translate. That's, again, the price of technology.
Do you have to watch your weight?
Do you
eat like everything you cook?
I worry about this intensely. I have an 18th century stomach, I guess. I'm the kind of person that puts on weight simply by rolling out the dough and touching it. Yes, I do. I watch my weight. I do eat everything. I mean, I taste it. But I eat a lot of raw vegetables, and I work out. And I'm still overweight by probably 15 pounds.
Hey, well, you know, some people say that's okay. That's actually healthier.
Well, I find if I go to the weight that I'm supposed to be on the health charts, then I get colds and viruses and very easily, so I get weak. Stay robust.
Food historian William Wyse Weaver. He's the author of the new book, America Eats, and curator of the current exhibit at the Museum of American Folk Art in New York on folk art and food.